I'm Senator Tom Wagoner from Kenai. I'm chairman of the Senate Resource Committee. I'd like to at this time introduce the members of my committee who are here in attendance. I have Gretchen Guest from Anchorage, Ralph Seekins from Fairbanks, Kim Melton from Juneau, and I'd also like to recognize at this time Pete Kelly in the back, senator from the Fairbanks area who now works for the University of Alaska. And with that, I'm going to turn the gavel over to my good friend Jay Ramirez to introduce the House members here in attendance and continue the meeting.
Thank you, Senator Wagner. Welcome, everybody. I want to cover the folks that are here from out of town first, that are the sitting legislators. Our friend Representative Paul Seaton from Homer came and joined us this morning. We're expecting Beth Cartula from Juneau is doing a little bit later this morning. Representative Berta Gardner, Representative Gabrielle Ledoux, Representative Kurt Olson, Judiciary Chair Lisa McGuire is here, Representative Guttenberg from Fairbanks. Vic Coring, Representative and Chair of House Oil and Gas, has joined us. And Mr. Speaker, John Harris is here, and my boss, Majority Leader John Coghill, is here. Mike Chenault, Co-Chair of Finance, is here. Representative Bill Stoltz, Vice Chair of Finance, and Representative Harry Crawford are here. Amongst our other guests, I think the most special guest that we have in the room would be the former Lieutenant Governor, and John Coghill's dad, Lieutenant Governor Jack Coghill, is here with us. And if we all give him a hand, it's always great.
We know he's very bashful, so he would never stand up.
Yes, right. always good to see him. We also have two sitting mayors that are here with us. Mayor Jason Mayrand from Nenana is here with us, as is Mayor Talrico of the Denali Borough. Mayor's here also, and much of the activity in the Nenana Basin would affect the land in these two mayors' issues areas. We also have former Mayor Rhonda Boyles is here with us, and Senator Terrio is on his way in the building. I see him right now, and then of course seated with us with years and years of experience that they still share with our community, our retired Representative Dr. Bud Fate and retired Representative Jeanette James, that's here with us. So with that, we're going to go ahead and commence. We're going to go with our speakers, and we will probably break at about 10 minutes to 12, and we'll have a courtesy van outside for any legislators that need a ride, or if you care to adopt a legislator and you're going to go to the chamber luncheon for the general membership luncheon, feel free to adopt one of our visitors, share the hospitality with them, and then we will pick things up as quickly as we can get back here, probably at 1:10 or 1:20. So today, before we commence into our program, I asked my dear friend Pastor Keenard from Zion Lutheran Church to lead us again in an invocation, and we'll do a pledge and get going with our program. If you please rise.
I offer this prayer acknowledging our debt to St. Francis. Heavenly Father, good morning. And as you've noticed, our work is not finished, nor will it probably ever be. We gather again as your grateful, courageous, responsible, visionary, honest, and wise stewards. Again this morning, there are echoes in our minds reports of war, domestic violence, terrorism, and yet again, the building of a wall. Lord, in what we do today, in some way, please make us instruments of your peace. Where there is hatred, let us sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is discord, union. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. Grant that we may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Amen. Amen.
Lieutenant Governor, would you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance this morning, please?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We do a PowerPoint. They can't do both at the same time. Thank you. We're going to begin our program this morning with Kevin Banks, who's a senior commercial analyst for the Department of Natural Resources, and Marie Crosley, who's a resource specialist. They both come up from Anchorage. Kevin's presentation this morning is going to be on the future potential of gas markets in Alaska Interior. And Marie's going to help us, and we look forward to your testimony. And we'll open things up for questions.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Ramos. Thank you for this opportunity, and to all of you, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I'm the Senior Commercial Analyst, Kevin Banks, at the Division of Oil and Gas, and I extend Mark Myers, the Director of Oil and Gas's, apologies for not making it today. He's down with several other grown-ups from my department in Houston working on the gas line project. On my right is Marie Crosley. Marie Crosley is a natural resource specialist and also is our liaison with the legislature. So if you have any questions afterwards or want to make arrangements to meet with us at any time during the next several months before the regular session begins, we'd be happy to accommodate you if we can. Marie will also have information about the interior exploration licenses and the status of their progress, should you have any questions while we're here at the podium. My talk today will be about the gas market outlook here in Alaska's interior. And by way of an apology, as you'll see as we get into my slides, there's I'm trained as an economist, and you'll see from these slides what that really means for you. These are better read in the privacy of your own home than to have me displaying them, but it reminds me of a Dilbert cartoon, one of my favorites, where a Dilbert is attending a course in macroeconomics, and a professorial type in front of a blackboard covered with diagrams explains that this shows why I know all about money, but I still dress like a flood victim. So you'll get some of that today from me. And we'll, oops, this will take a minute to get used to. Hello. I've gone too far. You want to bring me back to the beginning?
Jim?
Hey, Jeff.
I think you need to point it up at the projector there.
Oh, I could try that.
There we go.
Sure enough.
There we go. It's actually nothing wrong with the machine. It's me. Oops. I can go only one way, it seems. Let's get back to the beginning. There we go. I'll just point out the chart at the bottom that describes what could potentially be the growth in demand here in Fairbanks. The information here, I'll just describe a few features of future and present demand for natural gas. At the moment, with the Fairbank, the Alaska Natural Gas Company is delivering about 100 million cubic feet of gas a year into the Fairbanks area, and has established a pretty substantial customer base and a fair amount of infrastructure for the center of town, which is, a really important feature for the future of gas and gas use in the city, and also in the surrounding area around Fairbanks. We predict that, I think the numbers we have now show that in 2004 we're at about 500 million now. That's a pretty substantial growth. You know, year on year addition of about 100 million cubic feet a year. At the moment, about 46% of that is associated with residential uses, and about 64% is commercial. And obviously, I think it's fair to say that the commercial, in one respect, has carried the development because of the kind of demand that it can bring in, and then the consumers, the residential consumers, can benefit by having those infrastructure brought in. It's an indication of the kind of penetration you can expect for a gas market in the Fairbanks area. It's at the moment about 775 customers are hooked up to the gas system here, which in a Fairbanks-wide measure isn't a very deep penetration, but it's obviously higher in the service area that the Alaska Natural Gas Company serves. So there's a potential for considerable growth in Fairbanks as we anticipate similar kinds of penetration rates. As you get into the wider Fairbanks community, it becomes a little bit more difficult because folks in Fairbanks have a relatively low population density in the geography here. The next table represents a compilation of studies that DNR has had access to, some that we've done ourselves over the past several years, that'll give us some indication of where we might be going. If we say look to where we may be in about 2009 and then 2020, as I mentioned today, residential and commercial uses are about a half a billion cubic feet a year, 500 million cubic feet a year. But if gas is available, that's the big question, if gas is available to Fairbanks, we could see growth to $3 billion by 2009 and potentially 6.5 billion cubic feet a year by 2020, assuming the kinds of penetration rates and growth rates that we've seen already, as illustrated by the kind of growth that the Alaska Natural Gas Company has experienced. Power generation. At the moment, if we had gas and could supply the existing equipment here in the area, we would see something from $6.5 billion in 2009 rising to as much as 27 billion cubic feet in 2020. But that will depend on a couple of things. We assume that in a medium case, which I've listed there on the second row as 12 billion cubic feet, that Fairbanks can switch over to gas and provide most of the Fairbanks-wide area with gas-fired electricity. The high case of 27 billion assumes that we have the capability for gas-by-wire technology. In other words, a central power generation capability here in Fairbanks that serves the surrounding interior communities as far away as Tok, Delta Junction, Chena, and around the communities in the surrounding area. On the industrial side, and I think this is a point I can make here. You know, our demand here in Fairbanks is limited only by our imagination. So as a result, I show a medium case projected demand for gas of about 30 billion cubic feet in the interior region, but rising or potentially 300 billion cubic feet. And as I say, it only depends on what you can think of, how you would use what you could use gas for. Internet farms, for example, petrochemical facilities could use all of this gas, depending on its scale. A separator plant that strips out natural gas liquids from a main gas pipeline, say from the North Slope, would use as much as 74 billion cubic feet a year. Or we could have a facility like the Agri and Fertilizer Plant in Nikiski, where as much as 50 billion cubic feet a year could be consumed. Obviously, and this is a point that I'll be making later, if gas were free and you had all you wanted, you could get numbers like this. I suspect that that won't be the case, however. Another source of demand in the interior region, and something that we mustn't lose sight of, is that essentially Fairbanks in the South Central Cook Inlet region are, in a sense, connected. And either gas will be supplied from the interior into the Cook Inlet, or perhaps a gas pipeline from the North Slope is connected through the interior but via spur line into the Cook Inlet. And we show that the potential shortfalls of gas use in the Cook Inlet could be anywhere from by 2018 BCF to as much as 91 BCF. And those figures depend on what kind of reserve growth we could expect within the Cook Inlet region and whether or not there's the continued industrial demand that we see now for LNG exports and for fertilizer manufacturing. And now I will attempt to get to the next slide. If you flip over the table notes, I'm not sure that that'll be interesting to me, but I think I probably should move on. As I said before, we've been drawing on different studies. Econ 1 in 2002 did research for us, and then the Lukens Energy Group, in conjunction with work that they're doing for the negotiations and on the Alaska North Slope Gas Pipeline project, has provided information. And this slide represents what Econ 1 was telling us back in 2002, and to a certain extent, we see the same kinds of numbers in terms of order of magnitude from Lukens Energy. It kind of drills into the numbers that I was just giving you before. In yellow, we see today's baseline demand as of 2000 was 100 million cubic feet, or closer to a half a billion cubic feet in 2005. Their numbers, I'll point out, they predict that there could be expanded service for interior growth of as much as 4.3, I had indicated before, a potential of 6.5, just to give you an idea of how different studies have come up with different numbers. But I'll point out the ratios and some of the numbers for new and expanded industry for either a new fertilizer plant, kind of scale of a petrochemical plant, or what an internet server might be using. Now, these internet servers, as you know, it is a facility that burns a lot of electricity in order to operate server capabilities for web-based services and tie into the rest of the world via phone lines. Fuel switching for power comes to the same point I made before, that if you were generating electricity for the wider Fairbanks area, we could see a demand as much as 15 billion cubic feet a year for that kind of power. But if you were to supply electricity to all of the communities, or nearly all of the communities of the interior, it could be as much as another 12.5 billion cubic feet a year. Now, I'm going to talk just briefly about the Cook Inlet. It offers two lessons for us. You know, I wish I could do this. Want a page up for me? Oh, I see. There we go. This gives you an idea of what Cook Inlet's demand has been like for the last several years, well, since actually gas production. What I point out in this graphic is that LNG and ammonia, urea, fertilizer production accounts for about 60% of the demand for gas in the Cook Inlet. Another 7 or 8% goes to field operations, just operating the oil fields in the Cook Inlet Basin consumes a substantial volume of gas. That's the gray area across the top. That's an important feature to recognize as we talk about Cook Inlet demand. And as I said, Cook Inlet demand is going to have an influence on the interior markets as well. And I will show you a couple of graphics that kind of illustrate where we may be. This particular graphic shows what may happen. It was done for us by Econ 1 a couple of years ago, and I'll have a couple of other curves that are a little bit more current and a little bit more detailed. But it shows that under the blue area of this graph that we're starting to see gas supplies dropping off. The year-to-year gas supply is starting to fall down. If we have some kind of appreciation of gas supplies with a fairly active exploration and new reserve growth, you can see that would be the yellow portion of this graph. And The green portion represents the difference between the potential demand for gas in the Cook Inlet and the supply. And so by about 2009, as it has it, even with the growth in reserves, the demand will begin to exceed the supply of gas here. We might be able to help some. I don't know if help is the right word. If I were working for Agrium, I wouldn't like to hear this kind of news. Or if I worked for the ConocoPhillips Marathon LNG plant and saw that by removing exports from the equation, we can stave off this shortfall for some time. But in fact, what we see is it causes another problem. Demand may fall off, and you can see that little green triangle there above the black corner, which would suggest that, well, good, we've got a supply of gas that will extend out to 2013. We're all good for another 4 years as compared to the previous graph. But at the same time, what that means is that a fairly important driver in the market, LNG exports in this particular example, is taken out of the market. And it could have a fairly dramatic effect on exploration. So it's we're caught between a rock and a hard place. You want to be able to continue to add to the supply of gas in the Cook Inlet by encouraging explorers to go out and look for it. At the same time, in order to get through a gas shortfall, you have to pull demand off the market. It represents for me something that is something of a problem for the market to deal with. I might add, too, if you were to draw a line roughly parallel to that label that says potential for ANS demand for Cook Inlet, that would represent what it would look like if you take out the Agrium plant in that case. So a few more years of supply because of the cutback in demand, but now you've taken off a major customer. We have similar supply assumptions, as I've shown you before, that were done just recently by the Department of Energy. And the point I would make about this table or this graphic is to show that there are fairly substantially different supply features for the Cook Inlet Basin. The dark blue line represents where we think we may go if there were no further growth in reserves. The other two lines represent the difference in timing. If you add another trillion cubic feet of gas to the supply there, but depending on how quickly exploration can be brought online. And in each case, it's only a trillion cubic feet of gas, but the timing of that supply can be substantially affected by the kind of exploration activity. Now, this confusing graph, this goes to the flood victim kind of discussion I gave you before, represents the situation with no growth in production and what might happen if we can see that Agrium shuts down and the LNG plant stops exporting gas in 2009. What it illustrates, and I think it's somewhat important, is that gas isn't delivered into the market in nice steady averages. It's delivered in more volumes during the winter and considerably fewer volumes in the summer. And in the Cook Inlet, that is a swing that's much larger than most places in the lower 48. We are already, according to this graph, in a situation where our peak demand is not met by the average supply. And so we see producers in the Cook Inlet looking for storage. We've been at the department talking to producers to convert old gas properties into gas storage to allow for a more level production in the basin and a supply of gas can be delivered during the wintertime. This would also have us in a situation that even without the Agrium and LNG industrial demand, that the Cook Inlet is in a pretty considerable shortfall of gas by 2013. If we assume that those two plants, we want to keep those plants running, we would need gas now, a pipeline, or up from Fairbanks, from Nenana, for that matter, if there's gas there, supplying the Cook Inlet today at full rates. I might also add, I think you'll hear from Agrium later, I think Agrium will tell you that their response to this kind of a graph is to produce less at less than full capacity. A couple of notes on the gas pipeline from Fairbanks to the interior. Years ago, a study was done to examine the cost of building a pipeline from Anchorage to Fairbanks, and the cost was about $190 million. We've done a little bit of re-engineering of that study to see what it would take to run from Fairbanks to Anchorage. Well, fortunately, it's a little bit downhill to Anchorage, as I know most of you people in Fairbanks would realize it is. But it's also a lot more expensive just because of inflation. So we're looking at numbers that could be as much as $240 million for a 24-inch pipeline to the Cook Inlet. This gives you an idea of the kinds of tariffs or tolls that might be charged depending on the volume of gas heading that way. Now, that brings me to my next point, and that goes to the question of the price. As I said before, nothing limits, at this point, what demand for Nenana gas or North Slope gas in the interior would be, as long as you didn't have to pay for it. But this will give us a touchstone, just an example of what we might be looking at in terms of price, where Nenana will fit into the market, and even if it were to begin producing long before a North Slope gas pipeline were constructed. We have some estimates here from work that's also been done for us by Lukens Energy Group that shows a potential netback price on the North Slope of between $3.50 and $5.25. That represents a range of values that encompasses about what the price we believe will be about 80% of the time. Obviously, the prices swing up and down. And we use the AECO price since this was modeled after a highway project to the Alberta Energy facilities. AECO stands for the pricing hub in Alberta. We assume that you can deliver gas down a North Slope gas pipeline for roughly 36 cents to the Fairbanks region. And then facilities or equipment necessary to step down the pressure, strip out some of the liquids, would be another 7 cents, so that the city gate cost for gas in Fairbanks could be as much as $4 to $5.50 most of the time. That's how much it'll cost to buy gas from the North Slope. I think those of you that are using oil or those of you that are buying gas from the Alaska Gas Company would find that somewhat attractive, I think. To move gas on a spur line down to the Cook Inlet, remember, my friends down in Anchorage are going to need gas pretty soon. We're looking at prices with a spur line of about $1 to $1.40. Our city gate price will be between $4.88 and $7. I think the story to be told here is, number one, Nenana can supply into a market as long as it can beat that $3.93 to $5.68 price. And I should think, you know, we haven't done much modeling on it. We don't know how much gas is in the Nenana Basin yet. But that is a key feature. Even if the gas were to arrive from Nenana into the interior region, you may enjoy lower prices for a time. But in order to the optionality here, you either buy gas from a North Slope pipeline or gas from Nenana. Nenana will have to be competitive. And just to give you an indication, lastly, of where we are and what this actually means for us, a gas pipeline that delivers gas into the lower 48, whether it is through a LNG project in Valdez or a highway project into Alberta, means that the interior market, in some respects, will be connected to the wider lower 48 market through this kind of a net back calculation. And we see this is true for oil, for example, that the price of oil paid for by the local refineries here is based on a net back price that because 90% of the oil that's produced in Alaska is shipped to a market outside. So essentially, in spite of the fact that we live close to the source of energy here and enjoy some of the benefits of a lower tariff, getting fuel from the North Slope into the interior, or in the case of the other slide, even into Cook Inlet, the net back price, the price that we start with, is governed or generated by what's going on in the lower 48. This last graph illustrates a point. The most recent contract between Unocal and NSTAR has a price term embedded in it that's based on the Henry Hub. That's what the HH stands for in the title. It's a Henry Hub price. That's a pricing center in the Gulf of Mexico that basically is the widely traded on in the futures market. It is a reference for prices all over the lower 48. NSTAR, in an interest to assure a supply of gas, an uninterruptible supply of gas, I might add, and also to encourage new exploration in the inlet, has been willing to set a price that will achieve, at least as of January 2010, something in the same order of value as the prices I showed you on the previous graph. So that NSTAR is, in a sense, recognizing that no matter where gas comes from and new supplies of gas come from, it will have to be matched to the supplies of gas from elsewhere in the state of Alaska, including the Nanana Basin. Well, that's all I had for you today. I would like to offer any time we have left to answer any questions.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it. And let me remind all of our guests that the coffee, the beverages, the fruit available to all of you that would like to have a little light breakfast this morning. With that, I'd like to have you stay with us to answer a round of questions, and then we'll proceed on, and then we should have ample time after 11 o'clock to come back for more questions. Are there any questions for Kevin and Marie, Senator Terrio?
When you talked about you have the graph that indicates if electric generation here in the interior were switched over to gas, was that predicated on complete generation coming off of gas, or do you have a coal component still in there?
I think our assumptions is that it's entirely switched to gas.
Okay.
So that 6.5B in one of those tables represents burning nothing but gas up in the region.
And then also, can you give us an indication of when the department expects to get any kind of result from the exploration going on in the Nanana Basin, when any information is going to be available to the department about what's been found out there?
Senator Terrio, if you don't mind, I think I'll let Bob Swenson answer that question when he gets up here. I'm sure he's got a better handle than on that. I don't do rocks very well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator. Senator Wagner?
Kevin, I know this is kind of a stretch, and maybe it's a bad question to have you address at this time, but in the event that gas is delivered to Fairbanks, can you come up with a ballpark figure of what that would release in the terms of dollars into other parts of the economy in the city of Fairbanks? As far as buying power for the consumer after gas is delivered to Fairbanks, I know it's a real nebulous number at this time, but it's going to be a big number in the future compared to what they're paying now for their energy costs.
Well, I was looking at numbers that of about five. You're right; it is a stretch, and without knowing how much of a household's budget is spent on energy in the region, offhand. But we can see anyway that you go from a city gate price of about $7.758, which is the cost of oil or LNG supplied gas today per 1,000 MMBTU to something like five. You've released in and I'm trying to think how much gas do I use at home. Yeah, that's something maybe I could get back to you with a little back of the envelope calculation, but I really would need to look at the budget right now. But it represents a pretty substantial decrease in the cost of energy.
It will then put additional dollars elsewhere into the economy and the community, right?
I assume that would be correct.
Okay, thanks.
Are there any other questions for Kevin this morning from our panel? Kevin, I appreciate it a lot, and so to follow on with Senator Wagner, what for homeowners, for business owners, for folks that pay utilities. I think what the senator's getting at, and I'm interested in, is the movement of that disposable income from mortgage, insurance, and energy to heat our homes, which is so significant in the interior because of the cold. And so there is a dollar figure, but there's also a percentage figure out there what the energy savings would be. So if this Seagate price that you say is at $8 and you could move down to $5, there could be a savings of 40%. Is there a percentage that you can throw out there rather than a dollar amount for an average homeowner that would be the savings that could be realized if we were able to move from being a home heating oil, a diesel economy, to a natural gas-driven economy insofar as our use of hydrocarbons?
Well, assume that it is a 40%. I think many people in this room probably are more aware of than I am what their energy bill is. So let's...
$2.39 a gallon for home heating oil delivered to your home. 500-gallon tank would be $700, $800 per month during the winter for average lasting. 2 years ago, it was $300, $350.
So if it's $700 a month, we've just given you potentially $200 a month to spend on other things in that guesstimate. No, I don't think that is correct. I mean, my energy conversion has to be taken into account. Gas has less BTUs in it in some respects. I'm measuring when I'm... No. I hate doing arithmetic standing up, but assume that it is a 40% decrease in energy cost, then yeah, we are talking about a $200 decrease or a $200 increase in your home budget for other items.
Excellent. Thank you, Kevin. Any other questions for Mr. Banks? We'll just keep you here until we do some a broader question and answer here at 11 o'clock as we proceed through our program. Marie, thank you very much. Kevin, thank you very much. And we're going to bring up Bob Swenson with the Geological and Geophysical Survey. Bob just moved here from was it Juneau or Anchorage, Bob, that you moved here from? He's in a new resident to Fairbanks out in the Goldstream area, so we're happy to have you here. And if you could start up prior to your presentation and answer Senator Terrio's question about the rocks, we'd appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Good morning to everybody. Good morning, Chairman Wagner, Chairman Ramos, and distinguished guests. I do appreciate the chance to address this panel. I think it's a very, very important issue that obviously has a lot of interest. And Senator, could you repeat your question for me, please?
Well, I'm just wondering, as the state and the person in the department dealing with the companies that are doing the exploration, when do you expect to get any kind of indication on what promise there is out there for gas?
Thank you. Like any exploration cycle, especially in an area where we have very, very limited data, and I think that's one of the things that I'll be covering in my talk relatively extensively. The exploration cycle from the initial phase of data gathering to where you actually are in a development mode, if you find what you're looking for, is probably anywhere from 5 to 8 years. It can be accelerated. It depends on what, you know, the access is and what your timing is and how long you can be out in the field working, and there are a lot of different aspects of that, but that's a very typical sense. What you find early on, obviously, is going to depend on what the land ownership is, what the operator is willing to release, and then the wells, initially, if you do get production, actually can be held in confidence until they find out exactly what it is and establish at least a lease group of leases over any given thing. So you're looking anywhere from 3 to 8 years. Now, this mechanism here, if an economist actually had trouble operating it, I'm sure a geologist will have no chance of being able to operate this, but we will give it a try here. Ah, very good. What I'd like to do is first go over just a brief overview on the state. I think everyone in here understands that the state of Alaska has a tremendous resource base, both in minerals, as we saw yesterday, as well as oil and gas. The North Slope is clearly a world-class hydrocarbon basin. The Cook Inlet, as well as the North Slope, is also a world-class hydrocarbon basin. And as a result of that, many of the other basins in this state really have been on the back burner. There's been a tremendous amount of work done in both the Cook Inlet and the North Slope. And it's also important to keep in scale in mind. And what I've done here is just put Colorado over the top. Colorado, in its own right, is a very hydrocarbon-rich state. And that just gives you an idea of the scale of what we're dealing with within Alaska. My background is I've worked in all the basins outside of the North Slope in exploration and development for the last 15 years. And this next slide well, this is going to be fun. On the way. There we go. This next slide really talks to what folks working outside of the North Slope have to deal with. And I can tell you I do have blisters on my hand from pulling on that side of the boat. But I think really this is what this meeting is all about. It's really to get more to the forefront of what the resource potential is within the interior basins within Alaska.
I'd like that slide when you're done with your presentation.
There we go. This slide here I put in, this is a slide from USGS. Dave Hausnick and Ken Bird have done a tremendous job of trying to identify the resource base that we do have in Alaska. It's a very, very difficult job. It really depends on the amount of data and the quality of data that you have. This slide is directly related to the gas potential within the state. And if I can get this to forward, I apologize for this. As you can see in the first box, in southern Alaska, specifically within the Cook Inlet, we're looking at about 2 TCF of remaining reserves, mean estimate of 20 TCF. These are very broad numbers. I will address that in more detail. In central Alaska, thank you. In central Alaska, you can see the mean estimate is 9 TCF, and that's an important number, is that is a mean estimate, and we'll talk more to that on what those numbers really mean, because it's important, especially from a public realm, that we understand those things. Next slide, please. Got it. Northern Alaska, of course, is the big gorilla. It has currently over 33 TCF of gas reserves behind pipe. Tremendous amount of potential on the North Slope, and clearly is the most hydrocarbon prolific basin in Alaska. But we want to talk about central Alaska now. And this box that you see here with the range of 0.5, or that's 500 BCF or billion cubic feet of gas, to 7.3 TCF of gas, and that is conventionally recoverable reserves that they report, that the USGS reports, and the mean of 2.8. What usually gets reported, of course, is what the mean is. We see those numbers quite often, just a single number of 2.8 trillion cubic feet of gas. But the important thing to note here really is what the range is. And the range here, of course, being very, very broad. And I'll just discuss that real quickly. What usually a wide range of values in any probabilistic determination of the wide range of values really equates to a very limited data set or knowledge on the basin. And that limited data set or limited subsurface data really equates to high risk. And that suggests that all of our basins currently are in high risk. And it's also important to point out the difference between negative data and lack of data. The negative data meaning that if you had subsurface information like lack of source rock or something like that, that would give you a high-risk basin. But in the interior Alaska basins, it's really the lack of data. It's not that we've identified something that's against having gas there. It's just that we just don't know yet, and that's what we are trying to do currently. In exploration, in a wildcat area, usually you're looking at, and wildcat meaning, I think most everybody knows the term wildcat frontiers, 9 out of 10 of those wells, or 9 out of 10 of those exploration programs are failures, economic failures. You may find gas, but it may be an economic failure. But the important part of that is as you drill wells, as you continue gathering that data, your knowledge becomes that much better, and you can focus that exploration effort to focus in on any kind of plays. And innovative programs really are a key to help mitigate that risk. And one of the things that the state has done to help mitigate that risk in an innovative program is the exploration licensing program. Andex and Yusa Belly certainly are taking advantage of that. There's some other examples here. The Copper River Basin, which just there was a drill or a well drilled just this season. We don't have the results of that. So Susitna Basin, additional gravity data has been acquired. And we will be focusing, of course, here on the rest of this morning on the Nanana Basin, which is a very important basin for the Fairbanks area. Thank you. This slide, again, just points out specifically where the Nanana Basin is and in its relative scale. And that's an important thing that we'll be addressing again as well. Another important part of this is that Nanana is not really the only basin in interior Alaska, and these basins are all tertiary, and we'll talk to that. Mitch Yusebelli will be going into much greater detail on the local geology here, and that should be a very interesting talk. But we also have the Palitna-Minshumina as well as the Yukon Flats Basin that are as well very important and very potential basins for gas accumulations. Next slide. So one of the other ways to help mitigate that risk is to take a look at analogous basins, look at basins that have similar geology and make comparisons to those basins if that basin has a significant amount of data. Next slide, please. But it's also important to put into context the scale. The Nanana Basin, you see that small green circle, in comparison to the Cook Inlet, gives you an idea of the aerial extent of the Cook Inlet versus the aerial extent of the Nanana Basin. Next slide. But there are a number of similarities that will be pointed out. The tertiary stratigraphy, all these basins are tertiary in age. You don't need to understand the details of this graph other than the entire section that is located in the Cook Inlet is time equivalent as well as type of rock equivalent to that what we see in the Cook Inlet. Next slide, please. And the tertiary section is a non-marine basin. The photograph on the lower part of this graph, next slide, please. It just shows the type of depositional system. Many times, like the North Slope, we're looking at a marine basin where these rocks are deposited. And in all the interior basins, as well as the Cook Inlet, all these rocks were deposited in a non-marine setting. Next slide. And geologists love to look at these type of pictures and point out different features. We have a crevasse bay, point bar settings. These are reservoir rocks. These are the rocks that you would expect to find gas in that at once they're buried. Next slide. In a floodplain, or everything that is dark-colored on this slide, actually is what turns into coal once this gets buried. And over millions of years, as the basin subsides and you continue this style of deposition, this darker area here are the bogs and organic material turn into coal. Next slide, please. And in the Nanana Basin, this is a perfect example of it. This is what you see in outcrop. Once you've taken that rock to depth, heated it up, turned the organics to coal, and then through mountain building brought that back to the surface. And I think this slide will be shown again later. But perfect example of the overbank sequences, all those thick coal layers, and the non-marine sandstone that swept back and forth across the basin and provided the sandstone that will be used as reservoirs. Next slide. In the Cook Inlet, that depositional system actually has deposited over 25,000 feet, or almost 4.5 miles of that type of stratigraphy, so a tremendously thick section of that non-marine stratigraphy. Next slide. And it's also important to point out that the Cook Inlet has had a tremendous history of exploration. Since 1958, when Swanson River was discovered, there's been numerous discoveries throughout time. And as well, even recent times, we've seen a fair number of discoveries specifically in the gas realm. So it's important to note that it's not just a one-time effort. It's a continuation of our knowledge and gaining that knowledge and continuing with the models. We can continue to become better explorationists and find hydrocarbons. Next slide. I'll just show a couple slides real quickly about one of the fields I was a development geologist on, the Blue River Gas Field. Next slide. This is a seismic line through that structure, and this is what I'm hoping Mitch will show us from the seismic data that he's shown. I know he won't, but it would be nice to see this type of structure. This structure contains about 1.6 trillion cubic feet of gas, or did when it was first discovered. Very, very beautiful structure. very thick stacked non-rain section, the same type of section that we see in the Nanana Basin. But the history, the tectonic history and everything certainly has to be worked out to see if that's what we're going to see in the Nanana. Next slide. And this is what happens when you drill it. This is a section. Next slide, please. Down in the lower right corner, you see a structure map. The green line across the going from lower left to upper right is a line of section between all these wells. The yellow that you see there are all the different sandstone reservoirs. The black lines are the coals. And so you have thick, stacked reservoirs, and this is where those 1.6 TCF of gas is reservoired. Next slide. So when we jump to the Nanana Basin, how can we use those analogies to help us understand this? This map, again, will probably be shown here in a moment. Just to point out, though, that it does have a similar geometry. It does have a very deep section and shallow part of it. There's certainly going to be structuring and development of structures along the rim. But this map and all the data that we have so far are based on very, very limited data. And that's truly what Andex and Use Valley are out there doing right now, is trying to get to increase our knowledge of this basin. Next slide. And it just shows the cross-section and the type of rocks, and I won't go into the detail of that. I'm sure Mitch will. Next slide. So in this exploration license area that they have acquired, there's a work commitment, and part of that work commitment is to shoot seismic. I think the seismic is totally completed. Mitch will cover that here in a few moments, but that's going to be very, very important data as we move towards a better understanding in this area. Next slide. So to summarize, in the Nanana Basin area anyway, the Andex Resources holds the 7-year exploration license. It is a tertiary age fluvial setting, covers a tremendously large area with about 18,000 feet or possibly 18,000 feet of stratigraphy. It does have good potential for both coal bed methane and conventional natural gas, the conventional natural gas being, of course, an important part. The potential for oil here is very low. We don't have the same rocks underlying this basin as we do in the Cook Inlet, where we get the source for the oils in the Cook Inlet. We do truly only have very limited data. There's only two wells. Mitchell will be covering those, and a relatively old and relatively poor quality seismic data, but that of course, is what they've just finished. And both overall size and different tectonic history limits our ability to draw analogies, but we can draw those analogies from the reservoir standpoint. The current exploration effort will clearly help us in understanding the Nanana Basin and its potential for gas. Next slide, please. Excuse me. We cannot forget also that this is not the only basin in the interior. Yukon Flats, Hulitnum and Chumina. Once a better understanding is made in the Nanana, we should be able to extrapolate that data and understand both the Yukon Flats and other basins in the interior. Of course, they're more challenged from an infrastructure standpoint, but same geology. Next slide. This is just a slide from Chet Paris, some of the work he has done. We do have data. We do have an understanding, a limited understanding of what goes on in these other basins. Next slide. So in summary, interior Alaska sedimentary basins really do have a clear potential for gas accumulations. Currently, the available subsurface data is very limited. All interior basins should be considered high risk because of this lack of data, not because of the negative data. Data gathering and exploration is truly needed in all these interior basins to help us characterize this resource potential. And finally, the Nanana Basin Exploration Program is truly critical to that effort, and it should or could discover a viable resource for providing an alternate energy source for the interior Alaska residents. Thank you.
Bob, thank you for your presentation. Kind of questions do we have for Mr. Swenson? Excellent, Bob. Well, I appreciate it. If you will stay handy so that we can pick up with you after we hear from Mitch, Isabelli, and Jim Mary. Mitch, is Jim here this morning? Great. Nice to see you, sir. Okay, great.
Thank you. right, are we ready?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the House and Senate and committees, for the opportunity to present today. I understand I'll actually have the seat for the entire hour here, and while I'm more than happy and capable of speaking for an hour, I'm not sure you'll be happy to listen to me for an hour, so I'll try to accelerate through it, and we can maybe take questions a little bit early.
Take your time, Mitch. You're the star.
The other thing I understand you wanted me to cover, since we are in Fairbanks and we have an excellent turnout from the community here, is not only will I be doing an update from the presentations that we gave in Juneau this spring, but I want to do an overview of the project and the basin and kind of give the community a feel for really what's involved down here and some of the geology and why it's there and what we might find. So the Nenana Basin, as most of you know, is just outside of Nenana, southwest of Fairbanks. There are actually four participants in the project. Andex Resources is the operator, Doyon Limited, Yusevelli Energy, which I'm manager of, and Arctic Slope Regional Corporations are participants in the project. And just to give you a little information on each of those, Andex Resources is an independent oil and gas company with offices in Houston and Denver. They have participated in over 250 wells throughout the U.S., and so bring quite a bit of oil and gas experience to the project. Doyon, as most of you know, is also a landowner in the basin, or oil and gas leases that Doyon has granted to the group. They own the subsurface rights, and the Togatilli Village Corporation owns the surface rights on those lands. And Doyon actually is pretty critical in this, because Doyon really took the initiative about 5 years ago and compiled a lot of the initial data, seismic, wells, and did resource estimate, and they really attracted Andex to this project by doing so. Doyon also operates a separate drilling division. Yusevelli Energy is a new company that we formed to diversify, hopefully into a new source of energy in the interior to participate in this project. Obviously, we're very experienced in the coal-bearing units that we believe and appear to be located in this basin, as well as operating in the interior and in the energy markets in the interior. And then Arctic Slope Regional Corporation obviously has a lot of Alaskan oil and gas experience, and they also operate a separate oil and gas services division, which we have used for some of the engineering and permitting on this project. There's the general location map. See if the old laser pointer is working. And this is actually a shaded relief map, basically showing some of the topography and the basins throughout Alaska. And if we come in on detail, you can see here's Fairbanks, Nenana's right here. And if you look at these, you can see all these topographic highs, the mountainous areas. And adjacent to these, you see these flat lowlands. And these are the basins that we talk about when we talk about the interior basins. Nenana Basin's here. Yukon Flats Basin is here. Kandik Basin is to the east of it. We have the Minchumina Basin and the Holitna Basin down here. Susitna Basin, Copper River Basin, and Cook Inlet down in this area. And I'll be speaking a little bit, touching on some of those as a comparison. As far as the Nenana Basin goes, my characterization of it would be that it's an underexplored basin. There's about 350 miles of 2D historic seismic that was done by ARCO and Shell back in the early 80s, and there have been two shallow wells drilled on the perimeter of the basin, one in 1962 by Unocal to about 3,000 feet, and one in 1984 by ARCO to about 3,500 feet. But nobody has drilled in the basin proper to deeper depths, and so we don't know for certain what the materials are. Initial estimates that were done by Andex indicated that there could be as much of, or on an average, a mean